This is Payments Ground Game, where we go under the operational hood of payments ISOs. Let's take a deep dive into the tactics you can use to strategically scale performance and your bottom line. All right, welcome to another episode of Payments Ground Game. I'm Elena Smith. I'm here with Kevin Smith. Today, it's just the two of us. The past few episodes, we had some special guests, and I thought this time we'd bring it back to just the two of us. And today, I thought it would be a good idea if we cover the topic of BINs. And a BIN is a bank identification number. We're going to explain all the ins and outs of a BIN, why you might want to have your own BIN, what it means to have a BIN, and the responsibilities that are involved in that. It plays a big part in card processing and the relationships that we have with sponsor banks and the way they work with card networks. And I thought we would just cover all of that today and cover some misconceptions that are out there, I think, that I've seen floating around questions regarding BINs. So, Kevin, why don't you kind of just give us your overview of what a BIN is and kind of just put it in the context of payments and sponsor banks and card brands and whatnot?
Well, when you think of a BIN, you know, you've got BINs on both sides. You've got BINs on the acquiring side. You've got BINs on the issuing side. I guess the best way to think of BIN is whenever you get a credit card, the first six digits on your credit card are obviously going to start off with a 4 if it's a Visa, 5 if it's a MasterCard, but it's going to be 4 followed by 5 digits. Those 6 total digits on the front end of that card denote to the card associations who issued that card to you. So on the flip, on the other side, in the acquiring world, obviously, if you have issuing BINs, we're going to have acquiring BINs. So an acquiring bank is going to have a BIN, and generally that BIN is associated with the first 6 digits of the numerical merchant identification numbers that are assigned to merchants within that book of business. So, for example, our merchants all have merchant numbers that start off 461084. So that is that 461-08 is our BIN with the card associations that's through Synovus Bank. So all of our merchants are going to start off with that 6 digits in the front of their MID number.
And actually on the issuing side, I know recently they just changed that to be an 8-digit BIN, which probably wreaked all sorts of havoc on that side, but that didn't really affect us. So I guess we don't need to worry too much about that. We're still a 6-digit BIN. So that's fine. But one of the things that I hear commonly is people who have been doing this for a little while talking about having their own BIN. And so I'd like to talk about when does it make sense for you to pursue having your own BIN?
Well, I think we first need to realize that when someone tells you they have their own BIN, generally, I hate to say this, that's not the case. So when is there a benefit to having your own BIN? When you talk about things in with our business, we either talk about, you know, hey, what's your exit strategy? How is your exit strategy defined? Defining that is what is going to define really your BIN or whether or not you want to have a BIN. If you have a BIN and you are responsible for a specific BIN, in other words, all of your merchants are within a specific BIN and you have control of that specific BIN, that has portability capability associated with it that you don't have in a non or a shared BIN environment. Most folks today, believe it or not, are in some sort of shared BIN environment. What do we mean by that? There is one BIN and there's a whole bunch of ISOs that are writing business in that one BIN. They're not a group of ISOs writing or one ISO writing in one specific BIN.
And so, is there inherent risk in that, Kevin? If you're in a shared BIN environment, if something happens that I can't even imagine a scenario, but have you seen any scenarios where something happens to one of those ISOs and it affects the rest of the BIN or no?
No, generally you're not going to see that. And the reason you're not going to is because just the sheer number and diversity within the BIN. So let's talk about this in realistic terms. What is a large shared bin environment? Those of you that are using First Data today are, for the most part, in a shared bin environment. First Data provides the bin. You guys write for First Data. When you write your business, that's all going basically into all of those ISOs that write for First Data are all going into one shared bin environment. So there's an enormous amount of diversity with that bin. And what that means is generally the ratios, which we'll talk about a little bit later, that are associated and have to be maintained for bin compliance are generally fairly easily met because just of the sheer number of merchants and sheer number of amount of volume that's in that one bin.
Okay, so you alluded to managing risk and the ratios on a bin. Let's dive into that a little bit. Why do we care about ratios and risk management on a bin?
Well, it used to be back in the day, there was really only one thing you were worried about when it came to chargebacks, and that was whether or not your merchant was having a sufficient problem with chargebacks that they would cause them to get on one of the card association's chargeback programs. How did they get on that? Well, the old rule of thumb used to be they had more than 1% of their transactions were chargebacks, and their total number of chargebacks in any given month were more than 100. Okay, so that was all governed at the merchant level. To better combat some of this and some of the bad actors that were out there, there was no limit on how many chargebacks you could have or what that ratio had to be within your bin as a whole. The card associations were only worried about the merchant level. Well, now the card associations have implemented rules and ratios for chargebacks for your bin. So if your bin is over a certain ratio of chargebacks to sales, not at a merchant level, but at a bin level, then there are certain fines associated with that the card associations will fine you for until such time as you get the ratios back in line for that bin.
So one of the things that I saw recently was somebody who, you know, is going direct to merchants and asked, you know, what does it take for me to get my own bin? And they made it sound like the reason was that they just wanted to be able to do all this high-risk business that no one else would be able to take. And so their thought...
That's not the way it works.
Yeah, exactly. Their thought process was, well, I'll just get my own bin and I can put whatever I want on it. But then you run into this problem, like Kevin was saying, of your ratios are all going to be out of whack. So one of the most important things about having a bin is balancing that bin between low risk and high risk so that overall, as that portfolio, that bin, those ratios do not get out of whack. And just in general, I think for your own, I think the sponsor bank is probably also going to have an issue. If you've got too much high risk on that bin, they're going to want to be managing that risk, because if you have several merchants who go bad and you can't pay the liabilities for those merchants, if they run off for you, it's the ISO that has the bin and then it's the sponsor bank. So they are always going to be in a place of protecting themselves so that they don't get into that situation where they're having to cover unpaid debts of merchants that were in that bin.
That's why it's more difficult, in essence, to get your own bin, okay? You're going to have to find a sponsor bank that's willing to put up a bin for you, sponsor you into the card associations for that bin, not just sponsor you as an ISO, but sponsor you for that bin, okay? And they're generally going to require that you have a certain amount of financial stability, which is going to be associated with your balance sheet and your P&L. You're going to have to put up certain reserves associated with that. You're also going to have to demonstrate a capability or responsibility or to handle and manage that bin. What I mean by that is you've got to balance that bin, your settlement accounts on a daily basis. You need to be able to handle all of your risk reserves and make sure you can balance and ledger for all of that associated with that bin and report that generally back to your sponsor bank. And so, as you said, Elena, they're going to be more selective and make sure that you can do those types of things. Because if you can't do those types of things and you go out of business and you leave an enormous amount of debt associated with that bin from chargebacks, et cetera, coming in or fines, then it becomes the financial institution sponsor bank's responsibility. pay that.
Yeah. One of the things that you kind of rushed through there or glossed over is that the settlement accounting part of a BIN. And of course, me as a finance person, I think that's kind of a major part of having a BIN. When you have a BIN, you will have a settlement account. And this is where all of the money from the card brands comes into that settlement account. And that's the same account that you're paying out to your merchants. Well, when the card brands pay you and send you the wire every day, they're paying you less the interchange, less the assessments, less all the chargebacks that they've deducted for the day or that processing day. And they're paying you this net amount. Now you're turning around and paying out that net amount to merchants. And so
or
there's
the gross amount.
Yes. You could also, if you're not deducting those fees on a daily basis, you could be paying out the gross amount. But the important thing is that there's this reconciliation that has to go on that says, Visa said that I had 10 sales for $100, and on the other side, I'm paying out 10 sales for $100 to my merchants. And you're reconciling all of these things that are happening in and out of this account, because at the end of the day, that's a very easy way to lose money. You're not accounting for all of the items that were deducted from that settlement wire, and you're not collecting them appropriately. So that's a big part of it, is that reconciliation. A lot of people, I think, will outsource that to a processor or the sponsor bank. We actually do that in-house here. That's part of what we built on our platform. And it does it for us in about 5 minutes, which is a huge thing, because that's usually, I know full well, it's a more like a 4 or 5 hour manual exercise to translate all of these reconciliation reports that you get from the card brands and have to manually reconcile that. So that's a big piece of it. And I think it's not uncommon for that to be not as closely accounted as it should be. And then Kevin also mentioned the merchant reserves. We have a merchant reserve bank account with our sponsor bank that's sitting there that has a lump sum of all of our merchant reserve funds in this account. We have to not only know what merchant has what balance within that lump sum, we have to know how we arrived at that balance. So we have to support the full ledger of merchant and balance. And then at an individual merchant level, every single time that we made a deposit to that reserve, every single time that we made a withdrawal from that reserve, and we have a responsibility to the sponsor bank every month to show them that accounting for exactly what's in the reserve account. So when someone says, I want to have my own BIN because I just want to be able to put whatever high risk stuff that I can, it's kind of laughable. But it's also, I think, just we understand a lot of these things on a surface level, and we don't go deeper to know exactly what's happening behind the scenes, because for most people, this just happens and they don't understand that it's happening behind the scenes. But it's a really important part of managing a BIN. The other thing, too, is that if you're going to have your own BIN, you have to have your own processing relationship. So you're going to have to go out and get your own processing relationship. And Kevin, what does that normally look like, that fund process?
Yeah, so, you know, a lot of people out there, you know, they like to go to the place and put together their relationship for their business with one entity. So, for example, I'm going to go put together my relationship generally with a First Data, for example. I keep using First Data because I think they did a good job of putting everything together in a nice little package, and it's, you know, kind of off the shelf and to you. It's got a sponsor bank. It's got processing associated with it. And, you know, they charge you for all those little bits and pieces. But it's just, think of it this way. When you build a house, is it cheaper to hire someone that is going to do everything for you to build that house? Or is it cheaper for you to go buy the materials yourself, manage the contractors individually? It's going to require more work, but it is going to be drastically less expensive. So, as Elena said, we've gone out, we've shopped, we found our sponsor bank. Now we have to go find a processing relationship to put that with. So ours today is with TSYS and with NCR. TSYS does most of our authorizations and NCR does most of our clearing. But we have those as different. It's not one agreement that encompasses authorizations, clearing, and sponsorship. We have an agreement for sponsorship. We have an agreement for clearing. And we have an agreement for authorizations. Those are three separate agreements that have to be negotiated separately. And implemented separately. So it's not like an all-in-one box coming off the shelf. But like I said, if you think of it as, is it cheaper for me to hire someone to go do everything for me? Well, I'm going to pay more to hire somebody to do everything for me. Or am I going to get the pieces myself and get the materials myself, do it myself, manage it myself? It requires more effort. It requires more responsibility. It requires more skill to do it that way. But it is drastically less expensive, which means that we can be in a wholesale environment and have margin and still sell to our customers at a rate that is competitive in the market.
That makes sense. Let's talk about another component of this, which is that we would have to have responsibility over with our own bin, which is the underwriting piece. Talk to me a little bit about what it takes to build out an underwriting function in-house and how you work with your sponsor bank when it comes to underwriting.
Well, once again, this is another environment where we're talking about, you know, you better have the expertise in understanding what you're doing. You're going to have to demonstrate the expertise and understanding of what you're doing with the sponsor bank, or the sponsor bank is quite honestly just not going to give you the capability to do it. But a sponsor bank, so you're going to build onto something. So for example, your sponsor bank is going to come to you and say, these are the base guidelines that we operate within. This is the core base of the underwriting policy. And then they're going to ask you to put your policy together, which encompasses their policy, and put it back to them for approval. Once you've done that and you've put that together and you can demonstrate the skill that you understand what the hell you're doing, that you're just not rubber stamping things and throwing MIDs out there, then you're going to be able to do that stuff in-house. Now, when you can do that stuff in-house, once again, it's kind of taking on the responsibility yourself. If there's a mistake, it's nobody else's mistake under any circumstances except for yours. If you don't live by those philosophies of being able to take on those responsibilities, you can't take this on. Because once again, if you make a mistake in underwriting, if you approve something that you should not have approved, if you put up a merchant that you were supposed to run by the bank and you didn't, there are dire ramifications for not following those rules. And those dire ramifications can be the loss of your business like that.
Yeah, and we like to say no one merchant is ever worth jeopardizing that relationship. We really appreciate our relationship with Synovus. And that's just, it's been 13 years of building trust with Synovus. And the only way that you do that is you do what you say you're going to do. And you don't, when they tell you that they have a problem with something, then we have a conversation about it. And if it makes sense to tell that merchant to go away, then we tell that merchant to go away. It's just not worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And those of you that do business with us that are listening to this, that have had those conversations with me and had those conversations with Elena, you absolutely know 100% you have heard the saying that says, there ain't a damn merchant in the portfolio worth losing my business over. Period.
No, we've all worked too hard for that. So not worth it. So that's underwriting. And there are a lot of tools out there too that I know can help you with the underwriting process and help you kind of streamline that. We actually built our own in-house and we use our own tool so that we could automatically board to our processor without having to do any kind of manual data entry or anything. And I know there are others out there like that, that are wired to processors that you can do similar things with. But talk to me about risk and the risk function now, Kevin, because I think that's kind of the segue from underwriting goes directly into risk. We, you know, measured the risk of this merchant when we don't really know them that well. Now they start processing transactions. What kind of things do we need to be doing to monitor risk?
The simple things. And I know that this sounds really kind of silly, but guess what? What I'm looking for is to see, what are you doing differently than you told me you were going to do? If you said you were going to have this type of average ticket and you were going to do this type of volume, you were selling this kind of widget and you expected to receive, you know, do it via e-commerce or you expected to do it retail, you're measuring all of those components on a daily basis, looking at every single transaction that the merchant runs. Today, we bring all of those transactions in and we score them. We have about 21 different scoring mechanisms and looking at everything from each individual transaction to the batch size, to the percentage of the batch size that's foreign cards, to the percentage of batch that is declines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we're going to get that cumulative score and to know whether or not which merchant should we look at first. But you're really looking for, Elena, to see what things is the merchant doing or what are his habits that he's showing you that are different than what he told you he was going to do. And then what you need to do is you need to figure out, was that just poor communication? Was that he's a bad actor? Was that he's a criminal? You're going to go look at that. You're going to go pull up those items. You're going to put his account on hold. You're going to go ask that merchant, what are you doing? And depending on the response, depending on what you get back, is going to be determinant upon how you respond back with, okay, and we adjust things moving forward, or hell no, go find a new home. And, you know, that's not how we do things over here. That's, I know that sounds like a very broad spectrum, but it is a very broad spectrum that you're working with.
And you are really alluding to financial risk. We're trying to protect ourselves from, you know, losing money on this account. Maybe he's, you know, he can't, he's processing too much or something. But then there's also the risk of they're processing for products and services that they didn't tell us or disclose to us, that they didn't, you know, tell us in underwriting. And now there are ramifications to that, and we can face fines from that. So talk a little bit about the risk around that.
Yeah. So it's not just, you know, it's not just what are you selling? It's also how are you selling it? I know it's surprising. I know most of you probably have never run into this before, but there are people that will come in and tell you that they are selling one thing. Then when they get their MID, they run off and they try to sell something else. And generally, when people are doing that, it's because the something else is something they should not be selling because it's illegal or whatever.
Against the card brand rules.
Or against the card brand. The
card brands prohibit it.
And let me go and tell you, I know you guys don't believe this, but they are out there every day. Visa and MasterCard have super secret squirrel shoppers that are out there just combing the internet, trying to find people trying to sell peptides or people trying to sell marijuana or trying to sell cigarettes or whatever over the internet. And they'll go and make a purchase with their little card, and they'll wait to see where that thing got authorized. And guess what they come and look for? What BIN number was that authorized under? Then, once they see what BIN that's out there, they go to that bank and they say to that bank, hey, your merchant is selling this. We caught him selling this. We ran a transaction. Here it is. And then they come back to you and you say, oh, that's not what he told us. And they say, we don't give a shit whether that's what he told you or not. That's what he's doing. Here is your big shit sandwich fine. Enjoy it. Do you run into those things? Yes, you run into those things. Is it horrible? Yes. Is it painful? Yes. Is it expensive? Yes, but it does happen.
Is it easy to collect from the merchant? No, because they've already run off usually.
No, they've really already run off. But those are, you know, hey, that's the way it works. So, you know, once you approve the merchant, you know, we do a very good job of, once the merchant is approved, we put that merchant into a specific queue until we start seeing activity from that merchant, verifying what they're doing, how they're doing it, et cetera, before we move them into the general population.
So that's risk. We covered underwriting. Is there anything else that you think that we need to know about what the responsibilities are when it comes to managing a BIN?
You know, I think one of the things we hit on early that we need to expand a little bit on is, what is the importance of having your own BIN? Jesus, Kevin, you've told us all the nightmares about having your own BIN. Why would anybody want to do this? I can go over and get this off-the-shelf product over here that's already got all this stuff bundled up and I don't have to do anything with it. It's when you hear of sales in our industry and you hear of these sales of companies that are for numbers that you just can't quite wrap your head around. How did they get that kind of multiple? How did they get to that kind of number when they sold that company? Because their net profit isn't there. I mean, these are the things that when you go to sell your company is far more valuable. Because if I have my own BIN and all of my businesses on my BIN, and I have my own relationships for processing and acquiring and for BIN sponsorship, I can sell that entire book of business, its whole book together, and its profitability and its operational capability to a company. And it is far more valuable to them than it is buying a cash stream. You don't know when some of these larger organizations are going out to do these acquisitions or when you're going to sell. Somebody may be looking for a BIN sponsorship relationship that you have. They may not really give a crap about your portfolio. They may not really give a crap about anything you have except for that BIN sponsorship with that one specific bank that they really want and they're having a hard time getting it, or it's very painful for them to get. It may be easier for them to go overpay you to buy your BIN sponsorship and buy your business that already has it.
Or even a processing deal. You know, some of the processing arrangements that we have now, they're not offering them in the same way, front end only, back end only, that kind of thing. They're not available now in the same way. So it could be something as simple as that. It could be a part or piece that you put together to build this that someone needs and they can't otherwise get.
So when you hear of, you know, when you hear people talk about BIN, what's the most important thing about having your own BIN? That's how you truly are building an organization that is sold as an organization. It's not sold as a cash stream.
Or as a portfolio. I think it's what takes it from being a portfolio to
being a business
around that portfolio.
Right. It's the difference between a portfolio sale and a business sale.
All right. So I think we've covered everything when it comes to BINs, about how we work with sponsor banks to get a BIN, how those work with the card brands to process transactions through that BIN. What are the responsibilities of having a BIN, from underwriting to risk, managing the risk on that BIN, the reconciliation that you have to do on that BIN, how you go about getting a BIN, what kind of background you need to be able to even go down that path, and what kind of financial backing you need to be able to do that. So hopefully this sheds a little light on what is a BIN and why would it be important to having your own BIN as you build your business. And it's, I think it's fair to say, Kevin, it's not the right path for everyone. It is a path, but it's not the right path. It all depends on your goals and what you're trying to achieve.
No, absolutely agree. I would say it's really not the path for most. But, you know, it is the a path to go down and have the capability to do.
And even if you don't, hopefully this at least helps shed light as they manage that BIN on your behalf. That wraps up this episode of Payments Ground Game. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the show, please share it with others or leave a rating and review on your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again. We'll see you next time.